Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. One of the key Republican negotiators in the ongoing debt ceiling talks says a deal could be hours or days away. As the two sides move closer to an agreement which would avoid a default, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, says she believes the U.S. should get rid of the debt ceiling, citing the risks it poses to the global economy.
I strongly believe it can be eliminated altogether.
The Texas State House will hold an impeachment vote today on State Attorney General Ken Paxton. Republicans accused of bribery, unfitness for office, and abuse of public trust. A simple majority is needed to impeach Paxton, who would then be suspended from his job until a trial in the Senate. The TSA says it screened more than 2.7 million people on Friday, its highest number in a single day since 2019. And Vice President Kamala Harris delivering the commencement address at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. She is the first woman ever to do so. This is ABC News. Hundreds of thousands of Americans are in danger of losing their Medicaid coverage as pandemic-era benefits vanish with the end of the public health emergency. ABC's Rachel Scott has more from Washington.
Just weeks after pandemic-era protections expired, hundreds of thousands of Americans are finding out they may be without all-important Medicaid coverage.
They basically said, hey, sorry, you don't have insurance. We took you off the books.
States are now combing through the rules, trying to weed out people who they think no longer qualify. And at least 19 states have started removing people from their Medicaid rolls in a process known as unwinding, now causing confusion for families left without coverage.
Medical Licensing Board in Indiana Friday found a doctor violated privacy laws when she told the media about a 10-year-old rape victim from Ohio who had traveled to the state to get an abortion. Dr. Caitlin Bernard was ordered to pay about $3,000 in fines. She received a letter of reprimand, but is able to continue practicing medicine. Brian Clark, ABC News.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999. And again, 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats. And there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger. Featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown.
Monday mornings at 8 on WISS and WGB. And on the Civic Media app.
Oh, now wait until you pull up to the stop and go light. But when you do, go ahead and save the Civic Media station to one of your presets. The Cripes Cast with me, Charlie Behrens, and also on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. More people these days like to take their pets along when they leave the house. That means changes in laws and attitudes about things like dogs in restaurants. Mike Moen reports.
The Food and Drug Administration recently stated that pet dogs are fine in outdoor dining spaces. Madison Gottschalk of the Sioux Falls Area Humane Society says it's a good thing some businesses are now welcoming canines, but adds pet owners have to take on responsibility.
If you do get younger animal, you're going to have to put in so many hours to train it not to go in the bathroom inside, not to be aggressive towards food, not to be aggressive towards people.
Meanwhile, Gottschalk says it's important to plan out which type of animal is best suited for your lifestyle and home setting. That includes whether they're allowed by a landlord if you're renting. She says the Humane Society also offers guidance on how to introduce a new dog to another one that's already part of the household. And Gottschalk says budgeting for a pet is another part of the process. It goes beyond making sure they have enough food.
We make sure all of our animals, before they go out the door, are up to date on their vaccines, flea treatments, things like that. Those are all things that if you didn't adopt from us, you would have to spend your own personal money on.
Gottschalk says her location currently has a lot of pets available for adoption, especially dogs. She says there's enough variety to match a potential pet with an owner based on lifestyle, whether you like to go on adventures or prefer to hang out around the house. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
You were supposed to get a colon cancer screening, but stuff came up.
We did have to pick up the twins from practice.
But on the way, we hit a giant pothole.
If you are 45 and older, don't let stuff get in the way of your screening. Visit the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at ccalliance.org.
But then...
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning once again, and this is Jim Santel. This is Morning Cannolis, which is, of course, our weekly Saturday morning review, our analysis, our discussion of those most important news events and stories in our nation, around the world, having to do with law, government, and yes, the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for once again joining me for this second hour this morning, May 27th, 2023. When you think back on history, but also comment upon the times in which we live. Spending most of this first hour talking about our Supreme Court, both historically, decision rendered by the Supreme Court way back in 1935, having to do with one of the aspects of the New Deal proposed by and implemented by the president at that time, FDR, the impact the Supreme Court has then and to this day on our lives and our livelihoods, including just this past week, this major case involving the Sacketts out in Idaho, a decision that limits dramatically the capacity of the EPA to regulate our navigable waters, our waterways in the United States of America, joining, probably bookending, if you will, a decision just last term that restricted also the EPA's capacity under the Clean Air Act to regulate pollutants being belched out into our nation's air and our world's air by polluting industries. All of that very significant. And a reason to focus a lot on the Supreme Court, including the things that they say. Justice Gorsuch, as I indicated in the end of the first hour here this morning, commenting upon the restrictions imposed by our nation's state, local, and federal authorities that try to keep us safe and secure during the COVID pandemic here in our United States of America, and said this is a great civil intrusion, one of the greatest civil intrusions in our nation's history. With due respect, Mr. Justice, I disagree with you on that and acknowledge, as the Supreme Court itself has said, that we live in communities. And for that reason, there is no right. There is no right that is unconditional. And one of those conditions is to take care of each other, and that the laws of our nation's local, state, and federal are intended to do just that. We necessarily give up some of those civil liberties to do everything that we please on every day, in every circumstance, under every single environment, because we live in a place where people are with us. And that's, I think, what Justice Gorsuch is failing to understand. It is also a good thing that I can be on the radio commenting upon the commentary of one of our Supreme Court justices. That is also America. It's also the reason why we like to hear from you. This past hour, we heard from Tom raising some very important issues about abortion once again, and we're going to pick up on Tom's good comment and question about the numbers of abortions in America and talk about something that happened just this past week, happening as we speak, with respect to the accessibility of reproductive rights in America. Tom asking about the numbers of abortions, hearing in some media about the numbers of abortions historically certainly in recent times. And we know, number one, that it's somewhat difficult to assess with great particularity the exact number of abortions every single year. Most of these review the numbers assessed and brought together by the Centers for Disease Control has some great, great online information about this, but they too recognize that it's limited by the reporting capacity. The last national total, the data available from the CDC is back in 2020 and says that in 2020, there are about 620,000 abortions nationally. Our 47 states, District of Columbia, territories, and that represents about a 1.5% decrease from 2019. And indeed, if you look at the CDC's information about this, again, tempered a bit by the fact that it's dependent upon reporting by healthcare authorities and by others who might be engaging in medical services. Way back in 1973, there were about 740,000 abortions in America, reached perhaps a height, again, estimated by the CDC of somewhere around about just above a million, maybe 1.5, 1.6 million abortions, somewhere around 1990. And then it's slowly been declining ever since that time. And again, just this past year or so, the past couple of years, somewhere in the 600,000 range. And so we know those numbers are meaningful, but they don't plainly tell the whole story, even as much as we appreciate Tom's wonderful comment about the extent to which the issues of privacy and reproductive rights in America loom large, and they do, as Tom's question underscored. Significant that this past week we get yet another implication, another result of the Supreme Court's decision in June of last year, 11 months ago, to rescind the 1973 decision in Roe versus Wade, substituting instead the decision in Dobbs versus Reproductive Services that finds that there is no right to privacy in the Constitution for reproductive rights, and sending this back to the states. Which gets us to the major story of this past week. One of them, we talked right before the break about mifepristone. That matter now before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, almost certainly going to uphold a lower court decision finding that the FDA 23, 24 years ago improperly authorized the distribution, the use of mifepristone, not only for abortions, but also for other medical services, including miscarriages, finding, replacing the decision, the science-based, the medical-based decision of the FDA for its own assessment. Again, premised upon, but I would offer some bad science and misleading information. That before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, having been sent there by the Supreme Court, as this issue gets bandied about America, and yes, indeed, it's in South Carolina this past week as well. Just yesterday, a South Carolina state court judge temporarily blocked a new law in the state of South Carolina that restrict abortion access after only 6 weeks of pregnancy, a time when most women, I believe, are not even aware of the fact that they may be pregnant. That order from the South Carolina state court judge came just one day after the governor there in South Carolina, his name is Henry McMaster, he signed the 6-week ban into law. And the decision by Judge Clifton Newman, who said the status quo before the new law should be maintained, he said that I'm going to block this new ban, said it's going to end up in the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, probably the United States Supreme Court. He said it's going to end up there, and for that reason, I'm going to return this to the status quo. It should be maintained. The plaintiffs in this case, Greenville Women's Clinic, one of the abortion providers in South Carolina, also Planned Parenthood, sued the state shortly after the governor signed that law into effect just this past week. So again, we've got this contest now in the courts in South Carolina about whether or not that 6-week ban in the state legislation that was enacted, signed by the governor, should remain in place. It itself replaced a previous law in the state of South Carolina that had abortion access up to 22 weeks of pregnancy, which is much closer to the kinds of things that under Roe versus Wade, other states since 1973 until last summer had implemented. Now, why does it matter? Why does this matter? Once again, underscores the significance of this major decision by the Supreme Court that found that in our Constitution, We do not have a privacy right that implicates reproductive rights and permits women, and I would offer men as well, decision-making authority about abortions. South Carolina has become an important access point for abortion in the South generally because many other states in that region have banned the procedure entirely. And so many of the providers there, including Planned Parenthood, South Atlantic, others had indicated that we still are providing this service when other states in the area failed to do so. Interestingly, before that legislation was passed, three Republican women, part of the legislative entity there in South Carolina, had tried to block this near total ban on abortion, this new 6-week implementation of the limitation in South Carolina. The ban that finally passed prohibits most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, as I indicated, and requires that any woman seeking abortion first have 2 in-person doctor's visits and 2 ultrasounds. The law again passed by the legislature, signed by the governor, again his name, Henry McMaster, now stayed by a state court judge, in other words, suspending the implication, the application of this law. The law did allow exceptions for victims of rape and incest and in cases of fetal abnormalities that would result in death or the woman's life or health are at risk. But those exceptions are only available up to 12 weeks of pregnancy, which again gets back to the ultimate issue here, which is whether or not that does indeed not only restrict but limit dramatically the access of women and men, again, I would offer in South Carolina to this fundamental right. The South Carolina judge, Clifton Newman, this past week saying, no, we're going to suspend that. We're going to see what's going to happen here. He said it's going to the state Supreme Court, may ultimately end up in the United States Supreme Court. It is yet another example of not only the rescission of this important right that existed for nearly 49, almost 50 years in America, but also the confusion that it is now causing. South Carolina being among the states in the South that has different laws up until now than other states in the area, other states across our union, and the need for a revisiting of this issue, not only because of the importance that this takes in connection with civil rights and with human rights and the rights of privacy, but also other areas. We know that many of the justices, people looking at this, thinking that the decision in Dobbs of last June also opens up the door to the review of other privacy rights, rights to make medical decisions on your own, again, plainly to control your own body, which is implicated here, but also decisions about end-of-life treatment, to define a family as you want to define it, same sex, and even interracial marriage, all those kinds of things are privacy rights that inhere in the Constitution. The door is now open for the Supreme Court to revisit some of those. That's the reason why all of this discussion is so important, and that is the reason why, in answering what is I've often described as our third question here on the show, what do you do about this? Well, you petition your local legislators in your states. Certainly, getting back to our federal legislators, they indeed can in fact overturn the decision in Dobbs by passing legislation that restores Roe and restores the right under the Constitution. That can be done legislatively. And again, it comes only with the involvement of citizens in America responding to things of the sort happening in South Carolina and in other places around our nation. When we come back, talking about some other cases in our nation's history, and then in this second hour, talking about January 6th, some very important sentences imposed by a federal district court judge in Washington, D.C. Stay with us here on Morning Cannolis for that important discussion.
You wash your hands, you brush your teeth, but how do you clean your nose? With Navage. Navage uses powered suction to pull saline in one nostril, around the back of the nose, and out the other nostril, flushing out allergens, mucus, and germs. And it's why cleaning your nose, the body's air filter, is the next evolution in daily personal hygiene. Navage helps you breathe better, sleep deeper, and snore less, but the biggest payoff is improved health. at Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, Rite Aid, Target, and online. Navage, N-A-V, A-G-E, clean nose, healthy life.
Ready for our little forest adventure?
Yes!
We're here.
Whoa, that was fast.
There's a forest closer than you think. Find a park or forest near you and music inspired by nature at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by USDA Forest Service and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast. Ample sunshine expected this afternoon with highs around 76. Southeasterly winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. Lows level off around 47. Tonight, partly cloudy. A mix of clouds and sun. Tomorrow, daytime highs approaching 77. Low 80s. Monday, turning warmer on Tuesday with highs in the mid-80s. Once again, a high of 76 this afternoon. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Ray Miller. Right now, it's 73.
This is Civic Media for the Fox Valley.
We are back here in Morning Cannolis. Thank you for joining me and my wonderful producer, Anya. We're taking your phone calls, as always, at 844-967-2789. Great caller already this morning, Tom, calling in, talking about abortion. And again, a significant issue in the life and livelihood of our nation. Last week, we had a wonderful caller named Joe who called in and talked about public service and the significance of that. Gave me an opportunity to pontificate, if you will, about the significance of that. A story this past week. Happening right now, actually, maybe in a couple hours from now in the state of Texas, having to do with public service and the integrity that our public officials appointed, elected, should bring to their positions. What's going on in Texas today in about 2 to 3 hours from now? The Republican-dominated Texas House of Representatives has scheduled a vote for today at 1 p.m., again, a couple of hours, a little more than a couple hours from now, on the impeachment of the state's Republican Attorney General, Ken Paxton. We have not previously talked about Attorney General Paxton in the state of Texas. The vote set to take place just 2 days after a bipartisan but Republican-led committee of the House of Representatives recommended that Paxton should be impeached. A significant move in and of itself. You've got bipartisanship there in the state of Texas, finding that they should remove the attorney general of that state. Again, impeachment. Here's the civics lesson, of course, for the morning, not only in Texas, but around the country, including here in the state of Wisconsin. Impeachment is simply the vote to return charges. It's not the actual removal. And so if indeed in a couple of hours here at 1 o'clock, our time in the state of Texas, the House of Representatives does pass articles of impeachment, that would then move on to the Senate there in the state of Texas. And they would conduct a trial on whether or not their sitting present attorney general, his name is Ken Paxton, once again, should be removed from office. The attorney general has been handling a number of legal challenges. As you have probably noted, for many years, he's weathered multiple investigations and had few political repercussions. But again, on Friday, anticipating this vote today on whether or not he should be impeached, he denied any wrongdoing, invited his supporters to peacefully make their voices heard during the impeachment, again, happening at 1 o'clock today in the State House there in Austin. What's this all about? Well, in 2020, you may recall that several senior members of the Attorney General's staff wrote a letter, a public letter, urging an investigation into the actions of their boss at the time. And specifically, what did they do? They accused Mr. Paxton of using his office to serve the interests of a person named Nate Paul, P-A-U-L, who was a friend of the attorney general, according to most reporting, and also a political donor of his. Again, repercussions of other stories in the news these days. Paul is a wealthy real estate investor in Austin. He had contacted Mr. Paxton, according to these reports, after Neil's home and his offices were searched by federal agents in 2019. Paxton took the very unusual step. Again, we've seen this in another iteration, right? Against his staff's vociferous objections, he authorized a state investigation of the FBI's action searching Mr. Paul's home. Following all of that, Paxton, again, this state attorney general, directing state investigators to investigate the FBI were investigating his friend and political donor. He appointed an outside lawyer who referred himself as a special prosecutor, and investigators for the House committee said that he had no prosecutorial experience. The FBI has not commented on any of that. Paxton, along the way, said that he's never been motivated by a desire to protect a political donor, abuse his office at all, nor will I ever. In their 2020 letter, however, Paxton's aides said that he'd committed bribery, abuse of office, and other potential criminal offenses. Four of those aides had brought these concerns to the FBI and, yes, indeed, to state authorities there in Texas. They're the Texas Rangers. And those aides had relayed their concerns to the attorney general himself. Several weeks later, after they brought those allegations of very serious misconduct to the attorney general, all of them were fired. And the A's, of course, filed suit. As a result of that, they accused Mr. Paxton of retaliating against them. And that leads today to the committee, the House committee, filing 20 articles of impeachment against Mr. Paxton. They did that on Thursday. And as those matters are being addressed today, the articles charge the Attorney General, Ken Paxton, with sort of a litany of abuses, including taking bribes, disregarding his official duty, obstructing justice. There's a separate securities fraud case also pending against him, making false statements on official documents and reports, abusing the public trust, which, again, is the reason for my bringing this up this morning as we talk about the rule of law, the importance of integrity among our public officials appointed and elected. And again, in a little bit more than a couple of hours, the House of Representatives in Austin is going to be determining whether or not their attorney general, after all this time, many years, should be impeached. Charges brought against him. He's been under criminal indictment for most of his tenure as the attorney general. First year into office, he was charged with felonies related to those securities issues. He's denied wrongdoing in all of these cases, both in the criminal cases, in court, and certainly is fighting back against the return of articles of impeachment. But stay tuned to your local media and your national media, maybe even in Texas, because this is a big story, not just for Texas, but also for all of us interested in, once again, the integrity, the importance of our public officials executing their jobs without not only the reality of public corruption, but also this perception of impropriety, something we've talked about a lot in this broadcast, also in connection with our United States Supreme Court. We'll also comment as well about another issue just before we go to the next break, and that is E. Jean Carroll. Last month, won $5 million in damages from former President Donald Trump, now seeking a very substantial, is what she called it, additional amount in response to the insults that he hurled in her direction at that CNN town hall a day after she won her sexual abuse and defamation case. That now going ahead in the Manhattan federal court, intensifying probably the financial pain that Mr. Trump will suffer. Again, we'll keep on top of that and her continuing efforts to bring these matters to the attention of the courts and to the American public. Stay with us as we now turn to January 6th, right after this break.
Looking for something we can rely on. There's got to be some.
Fox Valley, regional and state news and commentary. For us to find common ground, civic media.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. One of the key Republican negotiators in the ongoing debt ceiling talks says a deal could be hours or days away. As the two sides move closer to an agreement which would avoid a default, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, says she believes the U.S. should get rid of the debt ceiling, citing the risks it poses to the global economy.
I strongly believe it can be eliminated altogether.
The Texas State House will hold an impeachment vote today on State Attorney General Ken Paxton. Republicans accused of bribery, unfitness for office, and abuse of public trust. A simple majority is needed to impeach Paxton, who would then be suspended from his job until a trial in the Senate. The TSA says it screened more than 2.7 million people on Friday, its highest number in a single day since 2019. And Vice President Kamala Harris delivering the commencement address at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. She is the first woman ever to do so. This is ABC News.
Don't change the station, but do watch out for deer, would ya? You know, they're running around all willy-nilly. It is the Krebscast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnair. Here's what you need to know. Home sales are down in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Realtors Association says existing home sales in April are down 32.5% compared to last year, largely due to a lack of inventory. And that means it remains a seller's market, with buyers facing plenty of competition and high prices. In order to get back to a more balanced state, Wisconsin would have to add 21,000 listings, more than double the number that are currently for sale. If you're going to be visiting state parks in Wisconsin this weekend, you may want to stop at less popular destinations. The DNR says it's expecting big crowds over the long weekend at Devil's Lake State Park. Alternatives include Mirror Lake, Governor Dodge, Natural Bridge State Park, Pike Lake, and the Great Sauk Trail. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
Yeah, I'm so stressed. Our business is growing. We've got people all over now.
Ooma.
What is that? Meditation?
I'm recommending the Ooma cloud phone system with auto attendant and more than 50 features.
Ooma?
Yep. Switching to Ooma is a cinch. Just $24.95 per month per user, plus taxes and fees.
Ooma.
Now you're feeling it. Find Small Business Calm at ooma.com/radio. That's ooma.com/radio.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hey, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha, 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 ha.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Joining me, continuing to join me this Saturday morning, we're going to talk now in the remaining segments of our broadcast about January 6th, an issue we've chatted about in great depth and hopefully with great understanding about what's going on here. We know that the United States Department of Justice undertaking the single largest prosecution initiative in its history to address perhaps a couple of thousand people who are on the ground on January 6th to attack our Capitol, to attempt to undermine the counting of electoral college votes on that day. More than 480 people have been sentenced so far in connection with the Capitol attack, all of them being prosecuted again by the U.S. Department of Justice, assistant U.S. attorneys in the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office. About 275 of them are serving at least some time in prison. And the terms have ranged from a high of 14 years, which is the highest sentence imposed until this past week, to only a few days behind bars, a few people getting a home arrest or time served. But great numbers of people in this huge initiative. This past week, some major sentence impositions by federal district court judges in the District of Columbia. Let's talk about the first one. Remember the Arkansas man who became famous or maybe notorious for putting his foot on the desk of Speaker Nancy Pelosi, entered into her office during the attack on the Capitol by him and other supporters of President Donald Trump seeking to overturn that Electoral College of counting going on minutes before they entered into the Capitol. On Wednesday of this past week, that man, his name is Richard Barnett, B-A-R-N-E-T-T, was sentenced by a federal district court judge named Christopher Cooper. Christopher Cooper sentenced him, Mr. Barnett, to 4.5 years in prison. Mr. Barnett is 63 years old. According to prosecutors, he arrived on the campus of the Capitol on January 6th, prepared for violence, intending to stop Mr. Trump from leaving office after losing the 2020 election. Back in January, for that conduct, Mr. Barnett was tried and found guilty by a district court panel, a district court jury. Barnett's testimony was during the course of that trial in his own defense, which he has a right to do. He testified that he'd ended up in Nancy Pelosi's office while looking for a bathroom, and that the 950,000-volt stun gun he was carrying that day was not working. This was all sort of a mistake. And, of course, in court papers, both prior to and after the trial itself, and certainly during the course of the sentencing, prosecutors taking a strong, strong objection to that minimizing role that Mr. Barnett himself was attempting to sell to the district court judge. Mr. Barnett maintaining during the course of this, again, that he didn't intend to do anything wrong here. He said, that, among other things, that he recognized along the way that he should not have done this. We'll get back to that in just a moment or so. But the judge, in responding to that kind of commentary, again, trying to limit his own culpability for his behavior on that day, said this. He said, Mr. Barnett recognizes no authority but himself and is willing to do whatever it takes to get what he wants. Before issuing the sentence, Judge Cooper said he was dismayed by the way Mr. Barnett had sought to cash in on his notoriety. He said this. He said, you're 63 years old. You're too old for this nonsense. This, again, coming from the district court judge sentencing Mr. Barnett. But for better or worse, you have become one of the faces of January 6th. And indeed, he has become that. You recall well his picture. You can see it online, not only in past years now, past weeks, but even this past day or so, sitting at Nancy Pelosi's desk. He said, for better or for worse, you'll become one of the faces of January 6th, and I think you enjoy it. That coming from the sentencing judge. The judge went on to say that this, of course, is not tolerable behavior. The lawyers for Mr. Barnett, as I said before, tried to minimize the involvement of Mr. Barnett. And the lawyers said in some court papers that Mr. Barnett still believed the police used a disproportionate response during the attack and tried once again to minimize his involvement. He said Mr. Barnett is outspoken about his political views and has attended dozens of rallies in his life, but was always peaceful and never violent, the lawyers on his behalf said. Along the way, it was very clear that Mr. Barnett had also, as the judge indicated, tried to monetize his notoriety by doing things out there online, other venues, to try to get money as a result of the notoriety that he had acquired during the course of this conduct. Mr. Barnett, this past week, imposed by the federal judge a sentence of 4.5 years for his involvement, reclining in Nancy Pelosi's office during the course of that, and carrying a stun gun that he maintained, again, was not working at the time. As significant as that is, it is not the most significant sentencing of this past week. Let's get to that right now. Stuart Rhodes, the leader of the far-right Oath Keepers militia, was sentenced just a couple of days ago on Thursday to 18 years in federal prison for his conviction on seditious conspiracy charges for his role that he played in helping to mobilize this pro-Trump attack on the Capitol on January 6th. You have seen his picture a lot. We have talked a lot about him in the past, including his trial. The sentence, which again was handed down by Judge Amit Mehta, M-E-H-H-T-A, a judge who is presiding over many of these proceedings, including sentencings of those defendants who are found guilty. Judge Mehta chided Mr. Rhodes for seeking for years through his leadership of the Oath Keepers to have American democracy devolve into violence. That's what Judge Mehta said at the time of the sentencing. This sentence, the 18-year sentence imposed upon Stuart Rhodes, is the most severe penalty so far, and again, more than in the about 1,000 criminal cases up to this point stemming from the Capitol attack. And it's also the first time that a federal district court judge has applied this enhancement, finding that the behavior qualifies as terrorism. Prosecutors had in the past attempted to get judges to apply that enhancement to increase the sentence. And all the judges had said, well, terrible behavior, violative of the law, but not terrorist in its nature. This past week, a federal district court judge, Judge Amit Mehta, once again found that the evidence presented during the course of the trial supported that specific finding. This comes at the end of a tumultuous and a very unusual career for Mr. Rhodes that included some Army service. Something was brought out during the course of the sentencing this past week. He had a stint on Capitol Hill as a staffer. He has a law degree from the Yale University Law School. But his role as the Oath Keepers founder and leader thrust him into the spotlight unmistakably and will now send him for prison for what is likely the better part of his life. He will plainly spend virtually all of those 18 years behind federal bars. And Judge Mehta said along the way that you, sir, present an ongoing threat and a peril to this country, to the republic, and the very fabric of our democracy. Strong words coming from the judge. As if to prove the government's point during the course of the trial and even the sentencing, Mr. Rhodes, who appeared during the sentencing in an orange prison smock and his trademark black eye patch, gave a defiant address to the court. He blamed the news media for demonizing the Oath Keepers, for leading to the attack. He also compared himself, and this again harkens back to the first comments that I made this morning on our program. He harkens back to the Soviet-era dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn and to the beleaguered main character in the Kafka novel, The Trial, said that you know, I'm falling in the same category as those people, Solzhenitsyn, who was persecuted by his government, and also this Kafka novel main character in this novel called The Trial. He said, I am a political prisoner in the same way that those fictitious individual was, and also that Solzhenitsyn was as well. Of course, a ridiculous proposition, nonetheless defiant to the end. The hearing opened this week, a whole series of sentencing, and that included also on the same day, the sentencings of one of his principal deputies, also there on January 6th, also engaging in this kind of activity, a woman named Kelly Meggs, who once led the Florida chapter of the Oath Keepers. She was sentenced to just less than that. She was sentenced to 12 years in prison at a separate proceeding in front of Judge Mehta. So we have this 14-year sentence, the 18-year sentence, the largest sentence ever imposed upon a Stuart Rhodes of among any of the defendants, and then 12 years on his deputy, Kelly Meggs. All of this taking place this past week. Along the way, we also get this very compelling testimony from some of the Capitol police officers. We've seen some of them in the hearings before the House Committee, the Special Committee on the January 6th attack. Harry Dunn, who was a Capitol police officer who encountered members of the Oath Keepers in the Capitol Rotunda, testified during the course of these sentencing proceedings. Officer Dunn saying this, he said, I'm an introverted, depressed shell of my former self as a result of what happened on that day. Mr. Dunn referred to the other officers who were injured on January 6th as the real Oath Keepers, and indeed he is right about that. And as he did that significantly, according to court watchers, Harry Dunn, the now former police officer there, shot what can only be described as an angry glance toward Mr. Rhodes and the other members of the group who were in the courtroom at that time. In court, the prosecutors persuaded Judge Mehta, as I said, to increase the sentence by arguing that his violence not only justified this strong sentence, but also that this plan to stage an arsenal of weapons outside of Washington should be punished as an act of terrorism. The prosecutor is saying this wasn't just blowing up a building, but organizing an armed force advocating for a bloody civil war, which came pretty close, according to the prosecutor. Once again, the judge, Judge Mehta, agreeing with that and imposing this very, very high sentence upon this particular defendant. Judge Mehta noting that this seditious conspiracy violation, this conviction, was among the most serious crimes an individual in America can commit. Again, as he also said, he scolded Mr. Rhodes, telling him that he had not been prosecuted because of his political beliefs, but rather because he had prepared to take up arms and foment revolution simply because he did not like the results of an election. Judge Mehta concluding by saying, "That's what you did. You're not a political prisoner, Mr. Rhodes. You're here because of your actions." 18 years imposed upon Stuart Rhodes, the strongest, longest imposition of a sentence. And then also this other sentence imposed upon his deputy, Kelly Meigs, the same day, 12 years imprisonment. What else do we know that happens also this past week? Just yesterday, a couple of other defendants, also a part of the Oath Keepers group. Their names are Kenneth Harrelson and Jessica Watkins. Also very, very interesting stories coming out of the sentencings of just this past week. Two Army veterans, again, among this Oath Keepers group, they stormed the U.S. Capitol in this military-style formation with these fellow members of the Oath Keepers. They were sentenced also to prison terms just yesterday after the far-right extremist group's founder received this 18-year term for the January 6th attack. Again, Judge Mehta imposing these sentences upon these additional two defendants. Jessica Watkins of Woodstock, Ohio, sentenced by Judge Mehta to 8 years and 6 months behind bars in the federal prison. And then also sentences Kenneth Harrelson, he comes from Titusville, Florida, to 4 years in prison. A federal jury had acquitted the two of them on the seditious conspiracy charges prior to the sentencing, but they were found guilty along with Rhodes and others of these other very serious offenses, including obstructing the Congress's certification of the electoral votes and otherwise attempting to undermine the process of the government. The judge gave Watkins and Harrelson far less time than prosecutors were seeking. The Justice Department, the AUSA there, had requested 18 years for Watkins and 15 years for Harrelson. Watkins and Harrelson both had marched toward the Capitol in this stack formation, as they indicated. We're going to talk more about the predicates for the sentence imposed when we come back, and then chat about the implications of all these sentences here on Morning Cannolis. Stay with us for this final segment this morning on our discussion.
If I could be you,
and you could be me, for just 1 hour.
If you could find a way
to get inside
each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Hello? I'm a Marine.
No matter how you served.
My buddies from the Army are all gone now. I'm really alone.
No matter what you're going through.
I keep getting calls about the bills, and I'm trying to get a job. I feel so stuck.
We are here for you. If you or a veteran in your life is experiencing thoughts of suicide, dial 988, then press 1 to reach the Veterans Crisis Line.
Here's your updated forecast. Ample sunshine expected this afternoon with highs around 76. Southeasterly winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. Lows level off around 47. Tonight, partly cloudy. A mix of clouds and sun. Tomorrow, daytime highs approaching 77. Low 80s Monday, turning warmer on Tuesday with highs in the mid-80s. Once again, a high of 76 this afternoon. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Ray Miller. Right now, it's 73.
News and talk. Up, down, and all around the Fox Valley. This is Civic Media.
We are back in this final segment of Morning Cannolis and chatting about these very significant sentences imposed upon Oath Keeper defendants. Now convicted defendants, the presumption of innocence no longer attends them, sentenced to these dramatic sentences by Judge Mehta in the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. this past week. I wanted to spend some time talking, as I began right before the break, about the sentences imposed upon Kenneth Harrelson, 4 years in prison, and Jessica Watkins, 8.5 years. And her particular story presents an interesting confluence of the kinds of things we see all the time in the federal district courts. This particular sentencing of just yesterday, no exception to that. Let's chat about her a bit more. The judge, again, sentencing Jessica Watkins to 8.5 years in prison, federal prison, on Friday. And significantly, the judge, Judge Mehta, who sentenced this Oath Keeper for her role in the insurrection, said that she could have used her identity to good. She could have used her identity as a transgender woman and an Army veteran to be a role model rather than a riot leader. So there's something significant there. Judge Mehta, again, sentencing her to this significant period of time. Watkins, a U.S. Army veteran, an Oath Keeper member who founded this local militia in Ohio, and mobilized to join her and others in attacking the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, prompting the judge to look at her as a human being and some of the challenges that she has faced, and nonetheless finding that her behavior justifies this imposition of a huge sentence. Much of Watkins' own emotional testimony during the course of the sentencing of just yesterday focused on her struggles as a trans woman in the military, a journey that she says made her fearful and paranoid and drove her deep into the world of conspiracy theories. Now, Judge Mehta acknowledged her hardship at Friday's sentencing, telling the court that Watkins' story itself shows a great deal of courage and resilience, an appropriate thing for a judge to identify. He said, "You've overcome a lot, and you're to be held out as someone who can actually be a role model for other people in that journey." And I say that at a time when people who are trans in our country are so often vilified and used for political purposes. But nonetheless, he said, that your suffering makes it all the more hard for me to understand the lack of empathy that you have for those who suffered that day. Indeed, Watkins, during the course of the sentencing, reflected that she had shown little remorse. But later, she apologized. She said she's now ashamed of her actions. Despite his empathy for Watkins, Mehta said, "Your role that day was more aggressive, more assaultive, and more purposeful than perhaps others. Your role in those events is more than just a foot soldier. I think you can appreciate that." She referred to herself as an idiot. Her words, not mine. And she said, now the idiots are having their day in court, being sentenced to these significant periods of imprisonment. All of that taking place in our nation's capital in response to the January 6th event and the continuing prosecutions, convictions, trials, sentencings going on for about 1,000, maybe as many as 2,000 people in the end, falling inside the investigative scope of the U.S. Department of Justice. I want to conclude this day by talking about Memorial Day. A Memorial Day that, again, is especially reverent today in our nation. We know that Memorial Day was first called Decoration Day
And it honors, at that time, his first invocations to this day, soldiers who lost their lives during the service to our nation. It was first declared a national holiday by our Congress as an act of 1971, but we know that its roots date back to the Civil War era, and that according to, of course, veterans who appeared, like the veterans who appeared in the show preceding this one on Don Brown's wonderful program this morning, veterans that we acknowledge, and Veterans Day, obviously November 11th, who continue to live among us, Memorial Day, an opportunity for us to think about the sacrifices made by veterans, laying down their lives for our nation's safety and our security. Unlike Veterans Day, Memorial Day honors those military members who have died while serving our nation. The first observance of what would become Memorial Day, some historians tell us, probably took place in, of all places, Charleston, South Carolina, at the site of a horse racing track that Confederates, during the course of the Civil War, had turned into a prison, and that prison apparently held Union prisoners during the course of the war. Black members of our population in that city organized a burial of deceased Union prisoners and built a fence around that site. And that, according to many historians, beginning this notion that we should acknowledge the losses, the ultimate sacrifices made by soldiers in our nation's history, that in the wake of the Civil War. Again, in many ways, Memorial Day, first called Decoration Day, the brainchild started by members of our citizenry, residents of our nation of color, significance in our history. On May 1 of 1865, the event of that time then included a parade. And again, blacks who fought in the Civil War participated in those first invocations, those convocations, those coming together of the community to commemorate the losses, these sacrifices made, some spiritual readings and songs and picnicking, all of that happening on May 1 of 1865. One of the first official decoration days identified as that time was held in Columbus, Mississippi, April 25th of 1866. That happened again as a part of our nation's history, moving toward Memorial Day as we presently know it. On May 5th of 1868, 3 years after the end of the Civil War, that traditional placing flowers on veterans' graves, which we continue to observe in the state of Wisconsin and communities throughout our state, throughout our nation, was continued by the establishment, again formally, of Decoration Day. That was happening by an organization of Union veterans, of veterans called the Grand Army of the Republic, acknowledging, remembering, and commemorating the important sacrifices made by soldiers in the Civil War and certainly beyond that. General Ulysses Grant presided over the first large observance, a crowd of about 5,000 people, at the Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia on May 30th of 1873. The orphaned children of soldiers and sailors killed during the war placed flowers and small American flags atop both Union and Confederate flags throughout that cemetery on that day. And again, we know that until World War I, Civil War soldiers were the only ones who were honored during this holiday. And now, since that time, all of our soldiers, Americans who have served in our nation's military, defending who we are as a nation, understanding the importance of going to war as the ultimate denigration, if you will, of relationships, but nonetheless, an important thing to do. Not only in the Civil War, World War I, World War II, the Korean conflict, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, all of our veterans, all of our soldiers lost in those periods of time, we recognize Memorial Day 2023. I encourage all of you to give some pensive thought to the losses that we have suffered in our nation, those ultimate sacrifices made by our soldiers in our nation's history. And I encourage you once again to come back and join us next week for our 50th broadcast here on Morning Cannolis. Thank you for joining me this morning. Have a good and thoughtful and memorable weekend. Good afternoon. Good morning.
Did you know more than 26,000 men and women from Wisconsin have died while serving their country. This Memorial Day, take time to honor their legacies. Here's former President Barack Obama on Memorial Day 2009.
We waged war so that we might know peace. We braved hardship so that we might know opportunity. We paid the ultimate price so that we might know freedom.
Join all of us at Civic Media as we salute those who gave their lives for our freedom.
Moving Day, a walk for Parkinson's, is happening around the country. Together we can unite in the fight against Parkinson's disease in a safe but exciting and fun way. So let's get moving. Join the Parkinson's Foundation to learn more and register at movingdaywalk.org.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
RPG came through the belly.
ABC News, I'm Brian.